You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops. But over time, the expectations.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Kim Scott. Kim is the co-founder of Radical Candor, an executive education firm on a mission to rid the world of bad bosses and create BS-free zones at work, if only God. Kim has been a CEO coach at Dropbox, Qualtrics, Twitter, and several other growth companies. She was a member of the faculty at Apple University, and before that led AdSense, YouTube, and DoubleClick teams at Google. Previously, Kim worked as a senior policy advisor at the FCC, managed a pediatric clinic in Kosovo, started a diamond cutting. You know, this actually does not sound real. Is this fake? Is this is all real?
It's all real. I really did start a diamond cutting factory in Moscow.
Oh, my God. Okay. And you recently released a fully revised and updated edition of your New York Times bestseller book, Radical Candor, Be a Kick-Ass Boss Without Losing Your Humanity. And Kim has partnered with the Second City Works on creating live workshops that use improvisational exercises to teach the elements of radical candor. And this new product called The Feedback Loop, an improvising radical candor workplace comedy series that will be coming to small screens across open office plans everywhere in March. This binge-worthy 5-episode series is a co-production of Radical Candor and Second City Works that includes after-episode action plans you and your team can put into practice immediately, along with improv exercises designed to teach everyone the skills they need to work better together. Kim Scott, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I will say the most fun I've ever had in my career is working with you all to create Improvising Radical Candor. So thank you for that, and thank you for having me.
Well, that's great. Well, and the interesting thing, I think, from our side is that, you know, when I was producing the theater side, we always did these mashups and collaborations, whether it be Lyric Opera or Hubbard Street Dance or the Goodman Theater and Center Theater Group. And that's not really something that happened much on the business side. So this was like our first business mashup, which is kind of a cool thing.
It's absolutely cool, and how much fun!
Yeah,
to put the creativity and the fun that you put into improv into the business side.
All right, I want to trace this conversation. Like, I want to figure out how we got to here. To like this, because I probably have made up a bunch of stories. You may have as well, like your resume. No, it's real. So I had you on. You were one of my very first guests on the podcast. So my first question for you is this. Did you have any preconceived notion? Like, why'd you say yes to it? And did you have preconceived notions about what that conversation might be?
I said yes because I was so excited to meet you. I had heard, at least to virtually meet you. I had heard of Yes And, mm-hmm. because I admire the Second City. And so that was really why I said yes. Also, I was selling a book I had just published. So yeah. I was eager to get the word out.
And I guess
I thought it would be a fun conversation. That was the main reason why I said yes. I always enjoy meeting new people and learning new stuff from them.
Yeah, me too. And I guess the one person we have in common at that point was Dick Costolo, who studied improvisation in Chicago and ended up becoming the CEO of Twitter.
Yeah, it turns out that improv skills are excellent CEO skills.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Absolutely. Okay. And then we convinced you to fly to Chicago to like play in a room for 2 days. I remember that, right?
Right.
And that was really fun, I think, because you know, my wife, Anne, was part of this group, and she had read Radical Candor. I was like, I need this. And really, she used it immediately in her role as a college professor and the head of the comedy program at Columbia College, both as a way to talk to faculty, fellow faculty, but also with her students. And mm-hmm. I think the framework was so powerful for her. And then we brought on, I think it was Becca and Bina, a couple of our improv teachers. And we just sat in one of our theaters and played out what it might look like if we, you know, improvised around the grid and other conversation as well.
Yeah. So how did Amy Sandler and I wind up in Chicago? I think part of what was happening was that I was getting, if you write a book about feedback, you're going to get a lot of feedback.
Of course.
And one of the pieces of feedback I kept getting from people was, it's really easy for you to say, be radically candid. It's really hard for us to do it. So you made one of the things that people liked about the book was that I broke it down into some practical suggestions, but I think I didn't break it down quite far enough. So how can we learn how to practice this? What's the best way to practice? And one of the things that you and I talked about on the phone is that nobody really likes a role play, because in some ways a role play is like asking somebody to play in a symphony before they've learned the instrument.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
And that's an awkward spot to be in, or to play in a scrimmage, you know, before you've learned how to kick the ball or mm-hmm. throw the ball or whatever. And so I think as you and I were talking, it became clear that improv has a bunch of drills that can help you learn the discrete skills that you need in order to be radically candid. So, for example, one of the things that got tweeted a lot was, listen with the intent to understand, not to respond. But how can you listen? How can you learn how to listen
right.
that way? And that's really what improv is all about, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's it's funny because, that is a thing we teach and a thing you're teaching as well. And I think, you know, there's so many of the very early, well, these improv exercises, right, they were developed by a social worker. They come from children's games. And what are we constantly trying to get children to do is listen. And I think we forget that it's not like we get better as adults. We figure out all other kinds of ways to not listen. We're very, very yes. skilled at that.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, one of the things I've learned in Radical Candor, but also as a parent, is learning how to listen to your children is vital, because they got a lot to teach us.
Yep, totally. And then you convinced us to fly to Silicon Valley mm-hmm. to play at your house for a couple of days. And that's where we really started to map out, okay, what would this look like if we were doing live workshops together? And I think did you have a whiteboard, or was it like a built-in board?
It was a big old whiteboard.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
I lugged into the living room.
I think I still have pictures, because we would take pictures at the end of the day, because we're like, someone has got to remember this. But I recall that actually being also very inspiring in terms of like, no, this is not going to necessarily be easy, but we're seeing how the thinking is progressing, that when we get in a room, at the very least, we're going to be engaging, and at the very best, people are going to walk away with some real skills that they can then put to practice.
Yes, and as I recall, we got some real radical candor from my son on that whiteboard, who came in, he was 8 at the time, and he scrawled all over it, "This is nonsense."
that could have been the title for the next book.
Exactly. So we had to adjust.
So I wasn't in the room for the first early workshops that you and our team delivered, but what was that experience like?
So we decided in some of those early improvising radical candor workshops to jump into some of the hardest conversations that any of us have right now at work, which is how to give someone feedback, or how to accept the feedback around sort of gender injustice, right?
That's right.
So confronting bias or even prejudice in the workplace, how can we use radical candor in those, what we were calling at the time, those gobsmacked moments.
Yeah.
And the amazing thing about those workshops were that these are the conversations that people dread probably more than just about any other conversations at work, maybe other than getting fired. And yet everyone laughed and had a great time. and learned a lot. And so it felt like this is a conversation that has become very heavy in the workplace. And we were able to remind people of the humanity of these moments and how to really confront them with what you call agency and grace. It was really inspiring.
It's really funny thinking back that like, oh yeah, no, let's start with this topic.
Yeah.
That's completely like,
That's the topic of my next book. So I guess that was front of mind.
But in
retrospect, we might've started with something a little easier,
I guess. But not only is it your book, but also the work that, you know, Anne and I worked on with the Second Science Project at the University of Chicago, which is really looking at, you know, the D&I space and how can we have these conversations. And my friend Heather Caruso, who's now the Associate Dean of Diversity and Inclusion at UCLA, she talks about, you know, getting people to understand that they treat other people differently and that has consequences.
Yes.
You know, you don't have to say any more. Gender, race doesn't matter. That is just what people do. And when you understand that, there's so many different ways that these things can play out. And then the only way that your behavior is perhaps going to change or you have the ability to be a little more wise or a little bit more sensitive or compassionate, which I think is a great word to use in this case, is if you practice a bit. And that's really scary for people.
Yes. But as you say very wisely, we practice all that. We practice accounting, we practice sports,
yeah.
We practice musical, but we don't practice being human.
Right.
And this is human practice.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to practice in an environment that's safe. You don't want to practice when you're in the meeting that's going to make or break your career. That's the time to execute on what you've already practiced on.
Yeah. So I honestly don't remember this. Who had the idea for a digital learning program?
So one of the things that we have really, that I've been thinking a lot about is how to teach at scale. So in fact, part of the reason why I wrote the book was that I was a CEO coach and I found I could only coach about 4 people at the same time effectively. Otherwise, I was getting people's stories confused.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a lot of people who I was dying to work with and who really wanted the advice. And so I thought, well, I'm telling all these people the same stuff, so I'm just going to write it down and publish the book. So in some ways, the book was an effort to scale. But people don't really... very few people change their behavior because they've read a book. It's a painful thing for an author to admit, but I think it's true.
Yes.
And so we were really thinking about how to help people change their behavior, how to build the habit of radical candor, because radical candor is all about these quick, impromptu, 2-minute conversations, and it's fast and it's free, and all it requires is enormous emotional discipline. So how do we build that emotional discipline? So I'm living in Silicon Valley, and the first thing I thought was, oh, well, there's an app for that. And we built this app. We raised money and built an app. It didn't work. We built another app. We built a third app. And suddenly I found myself watching my daughter perform a play.
Mm-hmm.
And she's 8 also. I have twins. And I was filming her on my phone, and I was sort of looking at her on the phone, and then I glanced up from the phone to the stage, and my daughter's up there singing "Believe It or Not, It's Just Me," and of course my eyes fill with tears, and the impact of actually looking away from your phone and at the actual person was really stunning.
Yeah.
And it was stunning that I hadn't seen it before, and I realized the goal of radical candor is to get people to put their devices away, look each other in the eye, and have real conversations, real human conversations. And so we went back to doing these talks and these workshops, but of course, humans don't scale. So how could we begin to describe the human drama of these moments and also the humor of these moments in a way that would scale? And I realized, and you realized, I don't know how we had the edit, but it suddenly dawned on us that we should make a sitcom.
Yep. I remember you actually brought up the idea because someone brought it up to you to turn radical candor into like a TV show, right?
Yes, yep. long ago somebody did, and I realized they were just going to mock it. They were going to mock the idea.
as so many seem to do with both Radical Candor and Yes And. As my friend Nir Eyal says, it's not a superpower unless it can be used for evil. So I think Radical Candor and Yes And are both superpowers.
Yes. And these folks in Hollywood were going to use it for evil. So I've been sort of thinking about it. Who would be a real partner on this? And you all have been that partner. It's been great.
So right in front of you. So here's what's interesting about this, and because I think it bears breaking down a bit, because it started with Radical Candor. Then we added improvisation, which is a essential sort of live element. We use improvisation to create our shows at Second City. Improvisation itself is not funny, but funny things arise out of people improvising, which we even noticed when we were in a room together.
Yes.
So the third thing we're introducing now is comedy. And what Second City and the Works Division has done previously is utilize comic messages to get people's attention. So we'll do that live and in at trade shows. We'll do it when we make commercials for people. But we've also done it in training. So we have a product called Real Biz Shirts, which is all about taking the very weighty and frankly boring world of ethics and compliance training from check the box to laugh at the thing that's in front of you that's telling you the thing that you have to go check the box in. So I think our brainstorming then went to, all right, well, what kinds of stories could we tell and in what fashion? And then we put you into our process, which was, I think I remember this, right? We said, here's like four or five different versions of what this thing could be.
Yes, such a great process. And they were all great.
Yeah.
It was very hard. There were four great ideas. It was really, really hard to choose. And I think as your wife Anne says often, we learn when we laugh.
Yeah.
And I think also part of Radical Candor is that if we can't laugh at it, if we can't challenge it by laughing at it, then we're not walking the walk. And so the humor, the various ways that you all came up with for explaining the idea and also laughing at the idea and showing how people get it wrong as well as how they get it right, was really powerful and cool. It's really cool to watch an idea that you have come to life, and you all breathed life into it.
Yeah, you were on set. So was that your first time you've ever been on something like that?
I've never done anything even remotely like it. And it was, one of the cool things I found about being on set is that the way that the actor, because there's a lot, as in all collaboration, there's a lot of repetitive
yes.
grunt work involved in putting something like that together. And the way the actors dealt with it is every time there was a down moment that could have been the moment when you lost energy, when you lost interest in the project, is they would just go on these sort of improv.
Yes, yes.
They were hilarious.
Yeah, they're called bits.
It was as much fun watching the downtime as watching the uptime. And I remember thinking, this is, every time I'm stuck in traffic or stuck in line at the grocery store, I'm going to try to be like these actors. Like, it's a brilliant way to live.
That's so funny. So we have terms for that. Like when you're on tour, there's a term called van funny, which is all the bits that you do in the van. And it is very much a thing for both stand-up comedy folks and improv folks. They can't, if their job is to be on, they can't really turn it off. So it's like, so it is. And when you're around as funny people as we got to do this series, I mean, this is like, and some of the people who are in this might not be household names. Some are, like David Alan Greer, but others are people who are on tons of TV shows. They just aren't, celebrities yet, like Ithamar Enriquez and Jean Villepique and, all these wonderful performers who just the things that they can, you'll have a script, which is, this is the thing I love, which I think you did too, which is I know the script's funny, but then they add like 40% more funny by the look that they give when they deliver it.
And sometimes 140%.
Yeah.
I mean, there was one line where a meeting is going to happen at 1 o'clock. And the actor made it hilarious. Like, I'll never have a meeting. I'll never view 1 o'clock the same. I'll always sing it. 1 o'clock.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Yeah. All right. What do you think about the ratio of learning to laughing? This is something I wrote down in my notes because I'm like, I wonder what that, like, I haven't broken it down, but your mind works like this. And I'm wondering what you think of when you think of those two things sort of crammed together.
So I think one of the things that makes this show work is that there's no jokes that are only there for the funny. Like, every joke is in service of the learning. And so I think it's kind of a one-to-one ratio. I mean, I think that...
Yeah, I think so.
...that you... There's no reason to think... And there's also no reason to think of the things that we are teaching as not funny or as boring. I mean, they're actually... Radical candor is the very stuff of human drama and human relationships.
Yeah, yeah.
And so every time you're getting it right, I mean, it's easier to be funny when you're getting it wrong, but even when you're getting it right, it can be quite funny. And I think that's what this show manages to do, is to help people distinguish between what's really radical candor and what's actually obnoxious aggression. And the ways that we try to get it right, but we accidentally get it wrong. And almost every single time, you're laughing as you're learning those things.
We had Joe Bowler on the Second City podcast, who is a learning
who
professor.
Who I love,
Oh,
Joe
you know
Bowler.
Her, yeah. Yeah. So she's at Stanford.
My children are learning Joe Bowler math every day.
That's so. In her book, she talks about the fact that we actually strengthen our neural pathways when we struggle with a problem. We don't learn by getting it right. We don't become smarter by getting it right, because we become smarter by getting it wrong. And that is and when you know this series, which is basically watching people get it wrong most of the time. Which I think is, again, if we're talking ratios, is probably the right ratio if we're tracking with reality. But I think that that same process will be going on for people when they're like, oh, you know, like, and it's in the same way that I think you could use The Office to teach a lot about what it's like to work in corporate America. It's not that fantastic, those things that happen on there. It's slightly exaggerated in my experience. I think yours too, right?
Yeah. But it can be really fun. Work can be it can be a BS-free zone. I'm also optimistic. It doesn't have to be that way. And I think that's sort of what this show shows, is that it can be inspiring and fun and satisfying to work with a group of people. It doesn't have to be awful.
So I did pop open, you have the new edition of Radical Candor, and it was really fun to reread. And I found it interesting that, and we touched on this a little bit at the beginning, but like you kind of open this with the fact that, you know, a certain television show, Silicon Valley, came on and you weren't watching that night, but you started to get texts and calls because they talked about, well, they mocked Radical Candor.
Yes, they mocked Radical Candor. It's so, okay to say.
Yeah, tell us about that.
So it was really funny because there's the CEO of the show is this sort of, he's learning very fast and he was trying to hire this super sophisticated kind of smarmy COO. And he really, first of all, he totally conflated radical candor and obnoxious aggression. He told the CEO he should fire this guy who's been a really wonderful employee and who the CEO really cared about. He should fire him, even if firing him would mean that he would lose his visa and be deported. It was like really terrible advice, really inhuman advice. And he called it, he did so in the name of radical candor. And the thing that is painful about watching that is it's true, people do often use radical candor as an excuse to act like a jerk.
Yeah.
Often I'll walk into a meeting with a company I'm working with, and somebody will come in and they'll say, in the spirit of radical candor, and then they'll proceed to act like a garden variety asshole. And that is not the spirit of radical candor. That's the spirit of obnoxious aggression. And so one of the things I wanted to do in the new edition is really, A, admit to this. Like, radical candor is a catchy title, but it is prone to misinterpretation. And so I offer a new version of the radical candor framework, in which the upper right-hand quadrant, where you are caring personally and challenging directly at the same time, is called compassionate candor. Mm. Just to remind people that of the care personally part of radical candor. And I think it's also useful to contrast compassionate candor with ruinous empathy, which is where we're so concerned about not hurting somebody's feelings that we don't say anything at all, and we avoid telling them something that they really would be better off knowing.
Right, because compassion is empathy, but plus action. That's
yes.
That's the difference.
Yes.
It's interesting. Words are so important to you, because I've been on these email trains where it's like not quite the right word, not quite the right word. And I think that's something that people need to pay attention to, because, you know, people also mistaking radical candor for radical transparency.
Which is a totally different deal.
Yeah, which is obnoxious aggression, quite frankly, I think.
It often manifests as obnoxious. I mean, there's not a lot of care personally in radical transparency. And also, frankly, relationships, which is radical candor is about how to have good relationships at work. And relationships require some privacy. And radical transparency makes it very difficult for a real human relationship to evolve.
We need a new word for soft skills.
Yeah, because there's first of all, they're so difficult. They're hard.
Yeah, they're hard.
And also they have real, they create real value. They create revenue. They prevent huge losses. They prevent planes from crashing, for example. So it is really important to develop these skills, these human skills. How about human skills?
Yeah, I think that we actually have that on our new. We've got this new list of words at Second City that's on there, because I mean it was always important in the data enabled world, the AI world. This is like now quadrupled in importance, because the jobs of the future are going to be the ones that only humans can do.
Yes.
So, I mean, if it's simple as you want to be employable, you are going to need to learn how to tell a story. You are going to need to be able to look someone in the eye. You are going to need to build trust. You are going to have divergent thinking and problem solving. And these are all the things that you can only do if you've got strong relationships, if you've got strong networks and communities of people to people.
Yes, and you know, it's really interesting. When we were building the app that failed, one of the engineers looked at me and he said, "You know, Kim, you keep telling people in these workshops you give, you keep telling people to bring what they already know about human relationships to work." And he said, "What you don't realize, Kim, is that people don't know anything about human relationships."
Wow.
You have to teach them. And again, that was another one of those moments where I thought, that is not in scope for this app. An app cannot teach people how to have relationships. But I do think that movies and novels and improv can teach people how to have human relationships.
I don't know if I told you about this, but I was talking to a professor the other day, and this guy, like 20 years ago, was a high-flying corporate executive, and he was just making millions of dollars, Canadian, and flying around all over the world. And he decided to take an improv class at Second City, and it so blew his mind that he quit his job and went for a PhD, convinced that he was going to bring the world, the academic world, improvisation. The minute he got hired into business school as a professor, no one cared about improvisation. And this was true if, you know, 20, 15 years ago. So what he did, though, was he was still convinced that there was something in the art and in theater and in ultimately what he claimed, what he talks about is performance. And he found a scholar at the University of Chicago, and I'm forgetting his name right now, who put out a book in 1957 or 1959, right around the time Second City was around. And he's a sociologist who talks about the way to understand ourselves in relation to others is us as performers. And we have an onstage persona and we have an offstage persona, but it is a persona and people are reacting to it based on how we look, our ethnicity, whether we have, something, you know, a deformity of some kind. And so we have to admit that we are our performers. And once we do that, we can maybe have a way to more skillfully manage our performances, our interactions in daily life. And I thought that was interesting that he although he couldn't move with improv, he's doing it now because people do accept it. But it still stayed in the realm of the arts.
Yeah, no, it's so, and how can you bring authenticity to that? Just because you're performing doesn't mean you're not being real.
Right.
And I think that's another common misperception that, that hopefully this improvising radical caner can blow out of the water.
Yeah, I hope so. All right, so we're coming to the end. I am not going to make you, you've given me many yes and stories. You are a walking yes and story. But I'm curious at the end here, if there's, I don't know, like, think 3 years ahead, 4 years, 5 years ahead. Where do you want our conversations to be? What do you hope our conversations are with regard to our human selves in the workplace?
I hope in 3 or 4 years that we will be talking about our realization that not everything that is important can scale, and that we are really working on learning how to value properly the things that don't scale, like teaching relationships, for example. Relationships don't scale. You can't have more than, you know, 5 or 6 deep relationships. You can have a lot of acquaintances, but nobody is quote unquote talented enough at relationships to have tons and tons of them, because there's only so many hours in the day, and relationships, if they're real, take time and one-on-one time, alone time. And so how are we, and teaching, I think part of the struggle that I've had with radical candor is that our economy values the things that scale. So if you can make it once and sell it a million times, that's great. But so much of these skills in order to build them, we need a back and forth. So how can we create a way to change our behavior that is doable, is achievable, but doesn't demand quote unquote scale? I think Silicon Valley has obsessed us all on scale, and we need to back off it.
Well, you would know. I mean, isn't that interesting that it's coming from someone who was working in that space in the time everything changed?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, one of the things I'm proudest of at Google is that we scaled. You know, we grew revenue 10x and the team shrunk 10%. So that's scale, right? But but it didn't. There are a lot of things that are far more important. My first novel that I ever wrote actually was called The Measurement Problem.
Huh.
And it's about how capitalism is so good at rewarding what we can measure and so bad at rewarding what we value. So I hope in 4 years we will have found a way to reward what we value.
Oh, that's so elegant. We're going to leave it there. Kim Scott, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Screaming atop of their lungs.
survive.